Welcome to I Might Believe in Fairies. I am your host, Aaron Erber. This is a podcast about stories, myths, and the Catholic faith. Welcome to I Might Believe in Fairies. This is Aaron Erber, and today I'm joined by Jane Charle, right? Is that how you pronounce it? Should have clarified that beforehand, but oh well. And we're going to talk today about her new play, and I'm going to butcher this too. We'll get to the title in a second, because I don't want to butcher that title, because I believe it's in French. So, Jane, you are an essayist, you're a poet, now a playwright. Just kind of give us some background. Where do you write your essays? You write a lot of, like, on, David Jones, is that the poet's name? You write a lot about him. I think you've written a lot about Eugene Vodolaskin, who I really like as well. I think you've written about him, right? I think.
Yes, I have.
Yes, you have. Okay, good. Yeah. I do some research before I have people on my show. I promise. Why don't you just give an introduction for yourself and your background and however much detail you want.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me on. Yes, like you said, I'm a poet, and I just recently started writing more essays. I was kind of inspired by a friend of mine, Morgan Meese, and if you're not familiar with his work, I definitely recommend it. He writes in this really interesting style, kind of the book-length essay, which not a lot of people are doing. It's not really personal essays, it's not really memoir, it's just book-length essays. really recommend his work a lot. And then I just finished this play, so that's sort of... I work in a lot of different genres, and I kind of publish everywhere. I don't have any collections of poetry out yet. I've got one that I'm piecing together, so we'll see if it gets picked up anywhere. But I also think that I think sometimes people rush to publish collections of poetry. So I'm willing to take that slow. So I just sort of write wherever people want me to. I do a little teaching, which is fun. I get to teach through Intercollegiate Studies Institute, ISI. And then I'm working on a course that would just be through me, and it'd be pretty affordable for people so that we could work through some of David Jones's longer poems, because he's a difficult poet. He's one of the 20th century modernists, and I think he's one of the best ones. He's difficult, like all the modernists. So I want to be able to help people know how to approach him and navigate his longer poems a little bit more easily. So that's sort of what I do. And then I also have two children and take care of them.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going on kid number four. So we're still bigger than they are. So it's, we can keep them in line a little bit, but not really. Yeah.
It's lots of fun.
Yeah, it is. It's a lot of fun. So maybe we should talk about how we kind of met. We actually were in like a Gene Wolfe discussion group, and we're still in that on Twitter. It's like a private little group with a bunch of, Catholics. And it's a lot of fun. It's kind of been inactive a little bit just because we're doing other things and not always reading Gene Wolfe. I will have a Gene Wolfe episode one of these days. He's just, he intimidates me so much. I don't even know where to start. But I'm thinking Wizard Knight. Anyway.
Yeah. Start with Wizard Knight.
Yeah.
Sure.
That's what draws me the most. So, but yeah, we kind of met there, and then you're like, I have a play, and then you sent me it. I'm like, this is really awesome. Let's have you on. And the play, why don't you say the name of the play?
Okay. It's Sonne le Mattine, which probably people would be familiar with. It's from the children's song Frère Jacques.
Yes, it is. Okay, that makes sense now. Yeah, all right.
That's where it's from. And that song was written in, the first instance of it that we have is a couple decades after my play, which my play is set in 1520, and I believe the first instance of Frère Jacques is from 1570, but people think it was written as kind of a French Counter-Reformation jingle, saying, why are you sleeping, monks? Come on, ring the bells.
Yeah, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, so that's why that's the title of the play.
Interesting. Yeah, and your play... so we'll just jump right into it. So your play kind of goes around three characters, and they're characters that two of which I recognize. I know, you know, Saint Ignatius of Loyola pretty well, and then John Calvin is the other one, and then which I think is awesome. And then the third character I was not familiar with at all. So Francois Rabelais, I think is how you pronounce it. Rabelais, okay.
Yep.
I tried looking up how to pronounce it, and it said Rabelais, or maybe it did say Rabelais. I can't remember. Anyway.
I think it can go. I mean, it's French, and it's older French. I have always said Rabelais and heard Rabelais, but I'm sure that someone listening in will have
I am an American from Minnesota, so I pronounce things how I want to pronounce them. No, I'm just kidding. It's like everything I pronounce is wrong, right?
That's funny.
So it focuses on those three characters, and it's a three character play. So they're the only characters in there. The other characters are mentioned, but they don't have lines. And it focuses around a murder mystery. And that's, it kind of fits, like, I like murder mysteries. You know, I'm a big fan of like Agatha Christie and, you know, those authors, Miss Marple and, Poirot. So yeah, why did you want to have a play, focusing on the murder, which we'll get to, the details of that, featuring these three characters?
Sure. Well, my husband and I went to Paris for kind of a delayed honeymoon in 2017. And while we were there, I remember hearing that John Calvin and Ignatius of Loyola, and actually Erasmus, were all at the University of Paris at the same time, and that Francois Rabelais was probably wandering in and out of Paris at that time. He's kind of hard to pin down. You really can only keep tabs on where he was in his early life because he keep getting thrown out of towns. So you can find like, oh, well, he was thrown out of this town in this year, so he must have been there, you know, this year to this year.
Yeah.
Just a real troublemaker. And I had first learned about Rabelais through Robertson Davies, who's the great Canadian novelist. He has a whole book called The Rebel Angels, which focuses on Rabelais. So that was where I first learned about Francois Rabelais, and then I went on to read some of Rabelais' novels, which are not for the faint of heart, but hilarious. So he was sort of he was the one who I knew the least about going into the writing process, but came to really, really love. And I think in a funny way, you've read the play, so this will make you laugh, but he's the one who, not in that I think he's right in everything he says, but he definitely he came to be my voice. So I've had a lot of trouble writing anything since I wrote his voice, because when I first start writing, the Rabelais voice comes out.
Yep. I can see that. Yeah. That's can be a problem. You know, yeah. You're trying to write something else.
Yes. His novels are all about, they're all about sex and the body,
yeah,
and overeating and overdrinking, and it's really just like a spectacle of physicality in his novels. And John Calvin ended up writing a letter specifically against him, condemning him both for the content of his novels and for not leaving the Catholic Church, because Rabelais stayed within the church for his whole life.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Cool. But then his books were banned.
Well,
so he really ended up, he got right in the thick of things during the Reformation and ended up getting on the bad side of everybody. So just a fascinating character.
Yeah.
So I remember hearing that all these men had been in Paris at the same time, and I thought that would be such a great story. And then when I started working on it, my husband and I couldn't remember who thought it should be a play, but he says it was him, and he has a better memory than me. So it was probably him. And I just started writing it from there. It's the first play I've written, so I really wanted to stick closely to Aristotle's Unities, keeping it as tight as possible. So really, it all happens within about an hour.
Yeah.
Really break. Yeah. So I wanted it to just be as tight as possible, because I really didn't know how to work in drama. So for this learning process, I wanted it to be really tight and neat that way.
It was. Yeah. I think you could do it in an hour. A three-person play. I think it would easily fit in an hour. And it takes place. So I like all the characters a lot. I really liked, obviously, Rabelais, but John Calvin and Rabelais were such a good foil for each other. And because they both come at physicality from such different places, and Ignatius almost seems indifferent to it. You know, he's like, whatever. He's got the...
He does take it for granted of, well, we have our bodies. We've got to figure out what to do with them.
Right, yeah.
And others seem to want to find a philosophy of the body.
Right, and Ignatius is just like, well, it's a mystery. I don't know. You know, with like how some of the answers he has, I think, was honestly kind of satisfying. Because it's like, sometimes we just have to be like, yeah, I don't know. The Eucharist is a mystery. You know, like, I can't understand it. It doesn't, yeah, yeah. It blows my mind. And it also takes place in Paris on Shrove Day, which is Fat Tuesday. Mm-hmm. So why did you have it on Fat Tuesday kind of going into Lent?
I honestly don't remember how that happened. I knew you were going to ask about this, and I was trying to remember when I made that decision. And I don't remember it. I remember I started writing in what is now the middle of the play. And as I was writing along, it just sort of became clear that it was Mardi Gras, mm-hmm. Because of the way that in my mind, the background noises and the background lights indicated that there was some sort of carnival going on. Yeah. And then it was just obvious to me. So I know that's not a very helpful answer, but.
Well, I think it's fitting because I think, you know, you have been reading a lot of Tim Powers, I know, and I am very interested to hear anything you want to say about it, but maybe a different time. But so with the Anubis Gates, I did a lot of research into why when he chose to have certain events happen. And it always coincided with the, not always, but the major ones coincided with like the liturgical calendar.
Yes. I noticed that in Declare too. I thought, man, if you're not Catholic, you really would be missing.
Yeah. Well, I was Catholic, and I took me, like, this is my second read through, and I'm like, something's going on here. Like, yeah. And then I'm like, oh, man, this is what he's doing. So I think having events take place on certain feast days and things, it lends, like, more significance to it. And I think having it be on Mardi Gras, this day of, like, revelry and, like, debauchery almost, but the characters can't indulge in it. Not that John Calvin or Ignatius would, but like Rabelais can't really indulge in that because of the murder, you know, that takes place and going into Lent where they have to take account for their complicity or lack thereof in this murder.
And I really wanted to explore what it means to have a body.
Yeah.
Because I think that's something that, I like to find questions that have been questions for the church all along, but now have sort of an extra layer of significance. And I think it's pretty easy to recognize that we're fuzzy on embodiment in our
right.
culture today.
Yeah.
So I was just really interested, and I didn't want to do something that felt ideological or didactic because I don't think that's how art works at mm-hmm. all. But I really wanted to just sit with the question of the body and of what role does the body play in salvation? So I think that's probably why it ended up being on Mardi Gras, because Mardi Gras really does go straight from embodiment in one form of we're expressing all of our physicality mm-hmm. and then straight into embodiment in another form where we are recognizing our physicality, but we're looking for ways to offer that physicality up in fasting and suffering.
Yeah.
And I think that both of those things are part of a healthy and Catholic understanding of the body. That's probably why I picked that time.
Well, it makes sense. Yeah. You have excess embodiment with Mardi Gras, and then you have the opposite, which is the, you know, aestheticism and curbing the vices and stuff. And I think you explore like beauty, and embodiment and physicality and the will, like, cause obviously it's John Calvin, right? So it's, you're going to have some, discussion on, you know, predestination, free will. Like, is it an illusion? Is it not? And, and I liked how, we can get into this a little more too, but I liked how, St. Ignatius, is the man of action, right? So he's the soldier. Mm-hmm. He makes decisions and he's like, we need to do this, you know? And, John Calvin is paralyzed almost with indecision because he's like, we're damned either way, you know? And Rabelais is just kind of does whatever, you know, he's very, he's either just following his own whims, or is he, you know, or is he, more coherent than we think? Or he's panicking and like freaking out and, you know, not able to control himself. So, yeah, it's very interesting how each of those, you do that very well with each character.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. And how they all kind of play off of one another. So going off of that, I'm not a poet. I know almost nothing about poetry, but I do know that poems rhyme sometimes and have a meter often. Mm-hmm. And I think you said once, or someone else said it, or maybe I noticed it, I don't know, but each character seems to have a different meter. Is that right? Okay.
Yes, they do. They sort of speak. It was funny when I did a dramatic reading of it with some friends. They were amazing. And they all said separately that it took them a little while to get used to this, because across a line, when the characters are all talking at the same time,
yeah,
across a line, it's kind of iambic pentameter, but it fits together. So one of them might have two of the feet, one might get one foot, and then the last one gets the other 2 feet. So it becomes an iambic pentameter line, but it's across 3 voices.
Right.
Which Shakespeare does that some, but I think I did it more and in smaller chunks than mm-hmm. Shakespeare did. So it took a minute for them to get used to that. But then when each of the 3 characters gets on a roll, he falls into his own unique pattern. So for Ignatius, he speaks in iambic tetrameter, which is, sorry, I have a cold.
I'm sorry.
I'm a preschooler, so I have a cold. There's just
it's always a cold. Yeah, we're always kind of sick too. My wife was just texting me today. She's like, "Yeah, I think I might be sick." Like, "Oh, come on, we just got over something."
It's funny. Ignatius speaks in iambic tetrameter, which is kind of a traditionally martial form. It's got the 4 feet, and it's really easy to march to. But then he also uses a lot of alliteration throughout, which I think kind of shows how he's aware of these underlying patterns, and he's just very comfortable with them. But he doesn't use the alliteration playfully. The alliteration is a very playful form, but not in Ignatius's hands. Mm. It's more structured, for him. But then for Calvin, he kind of just falls apart and speaks in blank verse, which is metered verse. He speaks in blank verse, which is metered verse with no rhyme and no alliteration, but then sometimes he doesn't have verse at all. It's just metered prose. Like when he really, really hits rock bottom outside the tavern, he isn't speaking in verse at all at that point. And then Rabelais speaks in rhyming couplets, which are a traditionally kind of like sexual erotic form. Fairly obvious reasons. So when he gets excited, he likes to make those kinds of jokes,
right?
And he likes to make sure that they're in couplets because it's funnier to him that way.
It's funnier all around. It's funny.
I agree. I think it's funnier.
Yeah, I was. I read this with my wife out loud. So I took Rabelais, of course. I wanted to be Rabelais, and then she had the other 2 characters. And then you know, when Rabelais would leave the scene, we would kind of switch off between Ignatius
He doesn't leave very often, though.
No. There's one point where he leaves and he goes into the bar, and it's just Ignatius and Calvin kind of going at each other. It's like kind of surprised. with Rabelais' lines, like, if there are children listening, this is a good time to maybe pause and listen to this later. But he says the smothering breasts of Lent or something like that are dangling above us or something. I'm like, what? I was reading it by myself at first. I'm like, okay, I gotta be done for now and come back with my wife and expose her to this too. This is really funny.
Sorry.
No, it's hilarious. And he's talking about the muck, you know, like all the gross muck. He's like, yeah, I've spewed my spill. And he always talks about, like, you know, going to the bathroom. But a lot more colorful than that. So he's got really funny ways of, like, you know, talking about body stuff. But it always has like a level of like, I don't know, a theological truth to it somehow, you know, where he's like, yeah, maybe not theological truth. I don't know. But there's always something, like, there's a point he's making, you know, that that is insightful, even though you just read a bunch of lines about various body parts. So, yeah, we had a great time reading
this.
I'm
glad. Yeah, it was supposed to be fun.
It was really fun. Yeah, and I really enjoyed John Calvin's lines, too, because he's just this neurotic basket case of a person, you know?
Oh, I read some biographies of him from when he was young. Mm-hmm. And I think that I even, like, pulled some punches on that. I think he was even in worse shape.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me. Well, yeah. I think a lot of heresies, and we're both Catholic, right? So I think a lot of heresies stem from neuroticism, not necessarily neuroticism, but like scrupulosity, you know.
Yeah,
like he was very scrupulous, this guy. John Calvin is, and in real life he was too. And you mentioned in the play where he says he tries to confess his sins to anybody who will listen, basically a priest, whatever, you know, and it never makes him feel better. He never feels better after it. He always feels the weight of his guilt. I think Luther was the same way. I think he was very similar in that he could not feel like he was absolved. It always was this like guilt hanging over him and driving him crazy, I think.
Yeah.
And so you really get at that, you know, and I do think, you probably pulled some punches with John Calvin. Cause I think he was a lot worse.
I mentioned this too when we were doing auditions. I think there are so many versions or ideas about John Calvin flying around. And he's kind of like Duns Scotus in this way, where he was one thing and then he started this whole movement that came after him. And it's difficult to distinguish between the man and the movement.
Yeah.
And I didn't want him in the play to just be sort of a straw man for Calvinism.
Right.
Because he wasn't even a straw man for what we all talk about as Calvinism.
Right.
And I actually grew up Calvinist, so I know it pretty well. And I know that even Calvinism isn't what people think of as Calvinism.
Right.
So I wanted to just really give more of a psychological look at Calvin the person instead of some sort of straw man critique of Calvinism, because I didn't think that was the function of his character in the play.
Right. I mean, he has good points, you know. It's like all your characters have good points about you know, various topics. Now, I don't always agree with each one of them, but I mean, obviously I probably agree with Ignatius the most, but just, you know, him being St. Ignatius. but yeah, so they all kind of, so at the beginning of the play, they all kind of come on stage, and Rabelais comes on and he's covered in blood and he's kind of running and panicking. And he brings them. So I think they're all kind of like, I think the conceit is they all know each other, you know, they're all like kind of college students together. That's kind of, cause I think Rabelais kind of seems like he's about their age, you know, and also a student, you know, in Paris. And he is like, oh, why don't we go over this way? And, you know, there's might be a tavern over here that we might like, you know. And he's trying to lead them over to the dead body, you know. So they eventually discover the dead body, and they're trying to figure out what to do. And each one of them has a different approach, you know, to how to deal with this, this horrible thing that they've discovered. And then each one tries to blame it on the other one, like, oh, you probably murdered them, or you did, or, you know. And so how did you go about constructing how they would react, each character, based on like their background and theological convictions? How did you kind of decide how they would react to a murder? I guess
that's a good question. It really did kind of just come from the language. I couldn't have told you what was going to happen as I was writing. I couldn't have said, oh, this is going to happen next. But I would say I need to cover this like, oh, Rabelais is having this response, so I need to write him a good speech for that. And then it would really become clear, oh, John Calvin's not going to like that. He's going to have something to say about that.
Right, or yeah, that makes sense.
Ignatius is going to decide that it's time to knock off all this yammering and make a decision or something. So it really did kind of just come together. I did a lot of research, though, on each of them. And before I would sit down to write, not every day, because sometimes it would take me, you know, a couple weeks to get through a scene or a sequence. But whenever there was time to make a change, I would kind of go back and I'd read Ignatius's letters, or I'd read something by Rabelais or something, just to make sure I was in their heads as much as I could be. And then it kind of just went. And I remember going down a couple of rabbit trails, and I'd get to the point where I'd say, oh man, this just is not what so-and-so would be doing. Yeah, and then I have to go back and delete a bunch of it and try again. So I don't know. It really was a character-led project the whole way. And Rabelais really did lead the... He was the one who carried it.
Yeah. He seems like the central character in the whole thing.
Which was a surprise to me. I wasn't expecting that. But as soon as he opened his mouth... It was declared, like, okay, this is what we're doing now.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's it makes sense. Like, there's something about it that makes sense, where he needs to be the central character, because he's the fool. And I don't know, like, is something appropriate about that, where he's not, like, he's not the hero, necessarily, I think. But there's something about him that he just kind of plays off of everybody else, you know?
Yeah. And I think that kind of comes from a bit of a theological conviction that I've developed. I think there's a lot more holy foolery in Christianity than we think, where, you know, we do all these things, we're serious about them, and they're important. But there is also a sense in which, like, grace is it's just a bit of a splendid kind of, it's gratuitous. So there's a sense in which I think the more we can laugh at our own, every time that we have a sense of, oh, I have a preconceived notion about what God is or what he's going to do, I think if we can cultivate a sense of being able to laugh at that and say, I don't know, I know what he's told me to do, so I'm going to do it, but I don't understand this economy, and I don't understand right. what's happening, you know? And I just think of St. Teresa of Avila, who regularly laughs at God in conversation with him. Like, she, like, regularly, like, teases him, which is just so fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I wanted Rabelais to have, I didn't intend it, but I think that he ended up kind of helping me clarify a little bit for myself of what I think the role of the fool is in the faith, because I think there's a fool in each of us, and we can choose if that fool is a holy fool or
right.
some other kind of fool.
like a mocking, like, cynical fool, exactly. You know, because I don't think Rabelais was cynical, you know, but he does mock, but not, I don't know, it's like Chesterton, you know, it's like Chesterton takes himself lightly, and that's how angels fly, yeah. or something, like, whatever the line is. But yeah, I think in the East, and we talked about this a little bit, I'm kind of getting more into Eastern Christianity, Eastern Catholicism a little bit. They have a holy fool tradition that we have too. You know, we have our holy fools, but we don't, like, see them as holy fools. Like the only exception is maybe St. Francis of Assisi. But we also have, like, St. Joseph of Cupertino, you know, who when he laughed, he'd fly, you know, he would experience joy. I mean, that's, I don't know what else you'd call that, but a holy fool, you know? But, you know, within Loras by Eugene Vodolaskin, that's all about a holy fool, right? That's the whole book is about what it means to be a holy fool. And
that book was really influential for me.
Yeah.
Both as a piece of art and also as a theological work.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Same with me. That's an amazing book. but yeah, we, in the East, they have this tradition that we don't, in the West, don't always think about. And it's almost kind of discouraged, you know, because everything needs to be so serious all the time. You know, there's problems in the church, there's problems in our country, there's problems all, it's like, yeah, but I don't know, sometimes things are funny, you can laugh at them. You know, sometimes yeah. God is funny. Sometimes God does funny things and we don't understand it. And all you can do is laugh and go, okay, I'll do this, whatever, you know?
Yeah. And I think there's some sanctity in that. Yeah, I don't know. And I'm not really a humor writer. So it was interesting to try to, I don't know. I guess I didn't really actually try to be funny. Just Ravelin was so funny. I couldn't stop him.
Right.
But yeah, I don't know. I think writing him really did kind of change the way that I think about the life of holiness. Not that he's holy.
No.
But he knows something a lot of us don't know.
Well, I mean, there's something about him that he isn't faithless, right? I mean, I was reading on Wikipedia about him the other day, and there was for a period of time, a bunch of scholars, the consensus was he was like a secular humanist, you know, before his time, and he was not a Christian, but that has kind of been overturned, and that they actually, the consensus was like, yeah, he was a Christian, and he was a Catholic. He had some criticisms of different things, like monasticism, but he was not favorable to Protestants, and he was a Catholic, you know, and he was a believer, very flawed, you know, but he... you know, was a believer and not.
And he persisted in that in the face of some pretty significant challenges. It would have been pretty easy for him to, you know, not. There were points in his life where it would have been pretty easy for him to, you know, no longer go to mass or things like that,
right.
Because he was always being thrown out of villages and stuff. And he seems to have always kind of come back around to it, even against some opposition. So
it's interesting. And he was also a doctor, which you get to in your play.
Yeah.
Those are spoilers. So now's the time for spoilers. If you don't want to, you know, spoil it, stop and go read it. It doesn't take long. So that it turns out that the murder victim is a woman. Why did you want to have the murder victim be a woman? As opposed to a man.
Well, I think I actually originally, when I outlined the play, which the outline went out the window pretty fast, but it was a man. And then the first scene that I wrote was that scene where they're kneeling and they discover that it's a woman. Mm-hmm. So I started writing it and I'd written about three lines. And then Rabelais made some joke about it being a woman. And I was like, oh, I guess this is a woman. Because it was just in the language when he was talking. There was, it was a woman. But then the more I started working on with that, it made a lot more sense. Because part of I think what happens in the play is you get this sense of claustrophobia where you have these three men who, for all they want to be super distinct from each other, they really are. They're all coming from the same background. They're all men. They're all allegedly celibate. They're all scholars. They're from the same class. So there's a sense of claustrophobia where they just are. They're just, and they're all talking at each other for an hour. Like they just talk and talk and talk. And there's a sense of, I mean, it's an ugly word, but there is a masturbatory element to it of the three of them in this space just trying to express themselves and to feel so intelligent and wise, but there's no voice that's really like cutting through and telling them you're being ridiculous.
Yeah.
And then Rabelais occasionally does that, but really, I mean, Rabelais is just one of them.
Right.
He's another, and there's nothing wrong with who they are. There's nothing wrong with that kind of person, but when you have that kind of person times three talking for an hour, it becomes a lot.
Yeah.
So it made a lot of sense to have this silent character, this one who was really driving the action, be someone completely different. Be a woman, be poor, be obviously not chaste.
Right.
That made a lot of sense to me, and to show how, I mean, I'm not an artist I'm not like terribly concerned about narrative and trying to make sure that, you know, art is balanced or any of that. It's really just what works in the story. But I think that if it had been a man, the story would have been missing a whole note, especially because it's a play about the body.
Right.
So, yeah, and then the more I worked with it, the more I just liked the idea of there being a murdered woman in this era where the church is being murdered and where the church has prostituted herself terribly. And so to have a murdered prostitute that these three wannabe priests are trying to figure out who killed her, it just made a lot of sense to me that that was how it happened.
Yeah. Yeah. What I like about your play is that everything that happens just seems natural, right? It just seems like this is the inevitable thing, that obviously this was going to happen, right? I mean, not until you get there that you realize that, yes, this is obviously it's a woman, right? That makes a lot of sense. But there's no hint about it until like, oh, they actually get close enough to look at the body, because they're all kind of hanging back and not willing to get close. And Rabelais is like, yeah, I don't touch bodies anymore because of the plague, you know? I'm like, yeah, it makes sense. I probably wouldn't get too close either, you know? But it makes sense that it's a woman. And then one of the interesting, or striking things when Rabelais, he wants to examine the body, right? And Ignatius wants him to go look at it. But John Calvin's like, no, cover it up, you know, cover the body up, let her have her dignity. But it's like, if you don't look at the body, you can't figure out what's going on. You can't there's no progression. You're just hiding, you know? So, and yeah, she's naked, right? She's naked and dead. She's a prostitute. And Rabelais is like, she was a mother at least once, you know, based on how, you know, her body is shaped. And he it's this moment of like sobriety for him, where he's actually engaging his, you know, he's actually a doctor in that moment. Right. And he's not just this like clown. And he's actually serious, and he's like, okay, we're doing this, you know? And just how they all react to the body, and how body and body with an AW are so similar in, you know, words. I don't know. It was just a really striking scene how, you know, each one reacted so differently, to the fact that it was a murdered prostitute, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess I don't have a question. I don't know.
Glad it struck me when it happened.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know, like, there's all these theological things that come up, and Rabelais kind of comes back again a couple times to the resurrection of the dead, where he, for all his, first, was he like, was he all talk in real life, or did he actually like sleep around quite a bit? I don't actually know.
It's not super clear.
Okay.
It seems that he probably was a busy fellow, but not, I don't know. It's difficult to say. There is one story about him that nobody's really been able to prove, but it floated around for long enough that it kind of, I don't know. I don't know. I even hesitate to mention it. So just know that it may or may not be true, but there was one allegation that he was involved in a circle of grave robbers and stealing bodies do like dissection and stuff.
I think that did happen. It's definitely
happening at the time. There was kind of an uptick of it even at that time, because with the rise of humanism, there was a lot more interest in, clearly not, the Middle Ages was clearly not the Dark Ages that we thought it was, but there were new methods being explored with humanism, and so people were really interested in dead bodies, and so can't confirm that that happened, but I thought that it was, you're an interesting person if that allegation can even be made against you.
Well, I don't even know if he would necessarily deny it, you know, he might dance around it, you know, and like, oh, maybe not, you know. Just based on, you know, who his character is. But yeah, he seems to have, like, there's a moment where he has this fear of the resurrection of the body, you know, where there's like a depth to him where he's all talk, and he's like, oh yeah, women are nice and bodies are great. And he has this speech about drinking alcohol, and it engages all of your body parts. And I'm like, oh man. And then he talks about, he goes outside and he's like, I don't want to be around when the resurrection happens, especially in France, because it's so cold that the bodies don't decay, or they do decay, but they don't, like, they're not buried. They just kind of stay on the surface. And I don't want to be around when that happens. So it's like this double-sided coin or whatever with him.
He does have I think he has I think they all have their hang-ups with the body, because we all do. Every one of us has hang-ups with the body, and I think he has more of a hang-up than he's willing to admit, probably having to do with his more clinical knowledge of it. He definitely is not at peace with it.
Right. Not in the way that he kind of lets on, you know?
Yeah.
And Ignatius has this dagger that was in his family for generations, and that was, more spoilers, it turns out to be the murder weapon, right? And so they each kind of, like, blame each other, you know, before they all kind of go, well, we don't actually know who did it, so we're all gonna... Ignatius wants to give himself up, you know, he wants to be there with the dagger when the body's discovered, because he's like, they'll know it's mine, you know, even though I didn't kill the person, but... They all have, like, this desire to, even Rabelais a little, to confess even though they didn't kill the person, right?
Yeah.
And that's that guilt they all share. So why did you have, I mean, I think John Calvin's probably obvious, right? But why did you have them all kind of, like, want to implicate themselves, at least briefly?
Well, I think some of that has to do with, on Mardi Gras, it's called Shrove Tuesday, because it's a reminder to go and get shriven, go and confess. And so they're all feeling this sense, they're keenly aware of their own sins, they're keenly aware how ill-prepared they are for the fast that's coming. And so they're trying to find things to confess, but I think there's I'm not sure that they're all willing to look deep enough, at least not until the end of the play, and confess the things that they really need to confess. Mm-hmm. It's easier for Ignatius to confess the thing that he's willing to confess than it is for him to really go deep and say, no, this is truly the sin that's keeping me from God. And then at the end, I think in his last speech, he begins to recognize that and to see what it is that's truly on his soul. I'm not sure that Calvin gets there. Calvin has one line, though, that when he said it, I really thought that it was interesting, where he said something about how going after grace, not in joy or even in faith, but in terror.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably the sin that he's afraid to confess, that he's afraid of grace, and that the only reason he's seeking grace is because everything else is more frightening, but he doesn't really believe. He's just so afraid that he has to do it. So I think each of them is trying to confess something. They're trying to get ready for the fast.
Yeah.
They don't know how. And here's this very obvious crime that each of them is a little bit associated with. And it's easier to just confess that crime than to figure out what they really need to confess.
Right.
I think that's what's going on.
Yeah. Well, here, I think this is the line here. I turn my back on you and flee to follow. Grace, not in hope, nor faith, but terror. I will go whatever I may find, and may that be accounted in my favor. I don't say farewell nor adieu. I only say that if my quest tonight should fail, and we meet again by chance, I think that all will not go well with you. And that's his last line, I think.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I just keep going back to Rabelais. He's so interesting. Because he's like, there is something about him where he is this really raunchy guy, but he is very insightful. And even John Calvin admits to that, you know, like Rabelais is often correct when predicting how normal people will behave, you know, even if he's not right ultimately about like different aspects of theology, it's like he normally will like... be able to predict how these peasants will behave with when John Calvin tries to confess to nothing. Yep. You know, like he goes and he's like, yeah, I heard a scream and, you know, I was drinking and I couldn't, you know, I didn't get up. And they're like, whatever. Okay.
What are you doing?
And then, and the funniest line I think was he was going to go back and try to pin it on, Rabelais, and then Rabelais like go back to the peasants and try to say, you know, oh, actually it wasn't me, and Rabelais makes fun of him and he says, what will you say? Oh, I've more before I blame myself, but now I'd like to blame that other fellow, you know, the one who came with me. See, I took a little hike just as you suggested, and I saw I had it wrong. Silly error, anyone might make it wasn't me, but him, forget my tears, the wine upon my breath and heed, there you'll find the doer of the deed. And then he says, what could they possibly find here to doubt? It's like, no, it you were right. It wasn't me. It was that guy. You know, it's like, well, yeah, like the guy who actually came with me to see if everything was okay. You know,
yeah. No, Gravelly is definitely not someone I would want to cross.
No, definitely not. Yeah, he's like he plays. It's like he plays the fool, but really he's quite intelligent and very perceptive.
He can handle a situation.
Yeah, and he can, but he messes up too. You know. Yeah, and he's hiding things as well from the other two.
Yeah.
The only one who really is the most innocent is probably Ignatius, because he's got his own flaws as well. But as far as, like, being involved in the crime, he didn't, you know, he was the most innocent of the three. Even though none of them, you know, spoilers again, none of them were the, it's not really a spoiler. I mean, none of them were the murderer, you know, None of them were. They still have like they're still like implicated in it a bit,
which is interesting because I've definitely had people who assumed that even at the end that Rabelais was the murderer.
Mm.
So I'm not actually sure. People have asked me, and I guess
it's not made clear, right? It's not made clear who it was, you know.
Yeah.
Which is I guess I at the end yesterday, like 2 days ago, when I was finishing it the second time, I'm like, yeah, we don't know. We don't know that Rabelais didn't kill her, you know?
Exactly. I think a director could play it either way and mm-hmm. be faithful to the language of it. And I don't think I meant to leave it that ambiguous, but
I think it works.
Also don't think I would change it, so yeah.
Right, yeah, I think it works well. Because you kind of come off thinking, oh yeah, none of them did it, it was somebody else, but I'm like, well, who else could it have been, you know? So, yeah, all in all, really, really fun. I had a really nice time reading it with my wife.
Well, good. I'm really glad. It's great to know that someone who doesn't regularly read poetry enjoyed it. That's kind of the goal.
Yeah, so that's a good point. So, I was kind of saying before, I'm not really a literary... I mean, I guess for most standards, maybe I'm a literary person. I read a lot of books. I think about books a lot. Gene Wolfe. Yeah. But like compared to actual literary people, I'm pretty small potatoes. But you were on a panel with some other very intelligent people. James Matthew Wilson, Matthew Walther, who's the editor of The Lamb. James Matthew Wilson mm-hmm. is another poet. Catholic poet, and Jaspreet Singh Bhopari, I think is how you pronounce.
Yeah.
I think mm-hmm. that's how you pronounce his name. You guys were on a panel called, I think the title was called "What Is the Catholic Imagination?" And you wanted, you know, Matthew Walther's point is that it really isn't one, and I don't agree with that. and you were really the only one who actually attempted to answer the question, other than there isn't one, right? So I appreciated that, you know. So how, like, in your opinion, what is the Catholic imagination?
Well, thanks to Matthew for putting together that panel. I have actually thought about that a fair bit. If you'd asked me a couple months ago, I don't know that I have a good answer. And also that all three of them were so delightful. I'd never met any of them before. And it was a really fun experience.
It was a great thing to listen to. I gotta say, it was really fun. Yeah.
So I think from my perspective, the Catholic imagination is it's the commonly held signs that indicate reality. So it's the sign, it's sort of the treasure house of signs that the artist can use and expect some sort of resonance in the audience's mind, with the purpose of showing beauty, showing truth, showing goodness, showing something transcendent. So the best example I can think of is the Eucharist, where the Eucharist is sort of the perfect sign, because it's where the sign being the host mm-hmm. is that which is signified. It is Christ. Obviously, Christ, when he walked on earth, was another perfect sign, because Christ, the body of Christ, was God. And that's, I think, what we are striving for when Catholics make art, is that kind of, we can't ever be that complete, but to bring the sign into proximity to that which is signified as closely as possible, because everything is a sign. The trees are a sign, the sky is a sign, everything is a sign that's showing us something, it's signifying something about God. And that doesn't mean that the world itself is fake.
Right.
It just means that we live in a world where there's multiple things being said all the time. So I think the Catholic imagination is one that is open to those signs, so aware of the possibility that anything you encounter is more than itself, but also is able to read the signs to some degree or another. And I think that we're shaky, especially on that second part, because we just aren't super aware of what the signs are telling us anymore.
Right.
I hope that's not too abstract.
Well, I mean, it kind of has to be a little bit, you know, cause I've struggled to, cause I agree. I think that's spot on. And I've struggled to kind of put into words, like how to articulate that, you know, and I was talking to Jonathan, Geltner.
Yeah.
And we talked about trees, you know, and trees, they're like a bridge, you know, between heaven and earth. Cause they reach for the heavens and they're implanted in the earth. And they're fractal, right? So they'll produce patterns, like repeating patterns, that kind of, you know, exponentially expand. And that is, I think, like recognizing that the thing, what it's doing, how it's growing, how it's being, reflects the higher reality of God, you know?
Well, and I'll say something on that too, because I did that translation of the Dream of the Rood with my friend Tessa. And when Matthew asked me about that, he didn't ask me to do it. He just asked if I knew anyone who knew Anglo-Saxon, which handily Tessa and I do know a little bit. But Matthew's kind of driving question there was, people don't know the language of the tree. Anymore, that the tree is the sign of our salvation, and they're losing that layers and layers of meaning, where they're forgetting the connotation of the cross as the tree is the cross. And then when you start thinking about trees that way as bridges between earth and heaven, you can see what's lost when we no longer think in terms of these signs. So that's exactly the kind of thing that I want to be more grounded in, and just learn to see the signs more.
Well, the book I'm reading right now, Hugo Rahner's Christian Myths and Greek Mysteries, or I always get that wrong. There it is. Greek Myths and Christian Mystery. He talks this second section, which I'll have an episode probably only for patrons, about that section, but it's all about botany. Not completely, but it's about how in the Odyssey, where Hermes gives Odysseus the moly plant, and it goes into the deep symbolism of the moly plant and why that was so significant. Cause he gave it to Odysseus to counteract the spells of, Circe.
Yeah.
And the reasons for that, why moly, why that plant, why, and then, he talks about mandrake roots, and why those were significant, for ancient Greeks up through the Middle Ages, like all the symbolism around those plants. And it's very interesting, and it's something that is completely lost today. Because I have a background in the sciences, right?
Yeah.
Nobody I know who's a scientist thinks like that. Nobody. Mm. You know, there's nobody like that. And whenever I would try, like, what is the purpose of this type of beetle? Like, what is this thing doing? What is its point? That would be openly, maybe not viciously, but ridiculed, you know. Like, well, it doesn't have a point. You know, evolution doesn't have a point. Like, nothing has a point, you know. And it's like, well, that's not a scientific thing to say. Like, how do you, like, go prove that nothing has a point? You know, like, go scientifically with an experiment, prove that life is pointless. Like, you can't. Like, so it's an assumption you've brought into the scientific method that's alien to it.
It is. Yeah. Have you read The Discarded Image?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Because I think that that gives such a clear explanation of what we have lost.
Mm-hmm.
And when we, for me at least, when I realized, oh my goodness, this is how people used to think, it helps me understand more about how we think now.
Right.
And that's something I'm trying to do in this Joan of Arc cycle that we've talked about a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Go into that a little bit. I'm very interested in that.
Well, it's not super far yet, but it's going to, I'm trying to write a poetic cycle about St. Joan of Arc and kind of do it in the style of either an Arthurian cycle or Charlemagne, 12 peers, that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
We've got this character who is historical, but is also more than historical and means more than, you know, the sum of her historical associations. And I think that's the case with Joan. And it's fun with Joan because we do have so much more historical information about her than we have about many of these other more mythic figures.
Yeah.
But I think the things that she is doing just naturally lend themselves to myth so well. And it's interesting to me that this hasn't been done yet. There are tons of stories and poems and interactions yeah. with Joan. But I haven't found one yet that makes of her more than a French symbol. So there's clearly a lot of that where she's, you know, mythic in the sense of France.
Mm-hmm.
But I think she's bigger than that, just like Arthur is bigger than England. And it's his deep association with England that enables him to be bigger than England.
Right.
So not at all saying that he's not first and foremost English, just like Joan is first and foremost French. Yeah, but in working on this, I'm trying to learn a lot about like the botany of the Loire Valley mm-hmm. and the area that Joan lived in, because I think that's where we're going to really find the mythic elements. So like what bushes were growing along the river when she took her force and had to cross the river to get to Orléans, because
right.
That sort of a thing.
Right.
And I'm learning about the folklore that had accrued about in that area. So what were sort of how did the old gods manifest in that part of the world?
Right.
Because I think Joan is going to come into conflict with those kinds of things as well. So it's been really, really interesting. And I'm basically trying to take a historical character and find out what her history means in a deeper, more mythic way.
I'm super excited for that. Because she also had some dealing, not dealings, but like with she has some interaction with fairies too,
mm-hmm.
Especially
yeah.
when she was a little girl. And
yeah.
according to Mark Twain, in his book, Joan of Arc, which is fantastic. Which is really surprising because Mark Twain was not a Christian man, but he
adored her.
Yeah, he just loved her so much. Yeah. And he did such a good job in that book capturing who she was, and without any cynicism, like at all. Like yes. he kept all of that out, which is
if you
surprising.
Read it and you didn't know it was by him, I think
you wouldn't know. He did yeah. that. He wrote it that way on purpose. I mean, he wrote it so he could distance himself as a person from it, which is interesting. But she had these like, there was this tree she'd have visions of, right? And if you had the visions of I haven't read the book in a while, but if you had a vision of this tree and it didn't have any flowers on it, you were going to die soon or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's that element too. And then like the fairies, that folklore and like the French peasantry and stuff, she was more favorable to the fairies in the book, but I also heard that that might not be accurate. Do you know anything about that? Like she maybe was more hostile to fairies. I don't know. I'd personally probably be hostile to them.
Yeah. So she, the main accusation brought against her, was that of witchcraft.
Oh yeah.
So she was very... She from the transcriptions of the trial, she did not denounce the fairies as demonic,
mm-hmm.
But she did say, I had no dealings with them.
Oh, I see.
Because they were not, I think it was getting to be late enough in human history that it was becoming clear that these things didn't have a place anymore. And I don't know whether they ever had a place with us, but it seems right. like they had a place with us at one point. So, but it seems like this was kind of one of the, it's kind of right before the tipping point where all of those things begin to fade. And Joan seemed to have recognized that regardless of what this was, it wasn't for her. And she did, some of her comrades like would speak with them and interact with them or leave them gifts and things, but she did not.
Interesting.
But the impression I have, and I need to do some more reading on this, but the impression I have is that she didn't have the strong reaction that we might have, you know, if our children came home and said, there's fairies, blah, blah, like, we might be like,
get the holy water.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't think she had that response. I think her response was more of, this isn't for me.
Interesting. Okay.
Which could be because she was already communing with St. Michael.
Right. Yeah. She didn't need the fairies. You know,
more she's, impressive. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
but it is really interesting. So I want to pull those kinds of things in and have kind of that. There's something so ambiguous is not quite the right word, but mysterious about those, you know, the long living people throughout history who weave in and out of our myths. And I just tend to think if something shows up in a myth over and over again, that it's probably indicative of something real.
Oh yeah, that's my opinion too. Like if every culture talks about something like vampires or has some sort of blood drinking monster, you know, there's something to that, you know.
There's something there.
Yeah, it might not be the Hollywood, you know, what we think of vampires now, but like there's something there, right? It's and it's the same with fairies too. Yeah.
Oh no, go ahead, sorry.
No, it's the same with fairies too. Like a lot of cultures have magical, vaguely aligned, you know, creatures that you don't know if they're good or bad. And
but they seem to be able to overpower us fairly easily.
Right. Yeah. So there's something to that, I think. Now, I've had people on who, like, yes, fairies are definitely real. You know, they're definitely not. Whatever. I don't know. But I've never seen one. I really don't want to. So.
I also have never had such experiences.
It's like, I don't want them. You know, it's like when I came back to the church, and I started like learning about the Marian apparitions and stuff. I'm like, I never want this to happen to me.
It'd be intense.
I'm like, I don't ever want Mary to appear to me. I don't want angels to appear and give me a mission to do. No, I'm good. My son is like, I want that very much. And I'm like, well, okay, well, sounds good. You go have that experience over here and I'll go over there. And
I think I would like it.
Oh man,
it'd be nice to have some clarity on all of these things, but
I'm just like, it'd be too intense for me. You know, I'd probably faint.
It would be intense.
Definitely. I'd go crazy. I don't know.
Well, angels are a big part of this cycle too.
Yeah.
Because obviously you have St. Michael, but then I'm also playing with the sort of the celestial hierarchy, where you've got angels who are assigned like to different thrones and different provinces and that kind of a thing. But then there's also a corresponding diabolical hierarchy where you have that which is opposing the angels.
Right.
So there's a lot of that going on too, where as you see Joan doing things on Earth, or sometimes even if Joan's not in the particular poem, because it's a cycle, it's not one big poem, it's different shorter poems that kind of all move around each other, and it's not written in chronological order.
Okay.
Joan's martyrdom is in the middle, and then it goes.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And then the last poem is it's from the perspective of Joan, and it's the day before she has her first vision. So it's her before any of this begins, watching the sunset and running home. So it's kind of like resetting, and everything is about to begin.
Yeah.
Cool. At the end of the cycle, which is kind of a traditional cycle form. There's always a little bit of that open-endedness in a cycle. Arthur going to Avalon and all that stuff. So within it, there's some overt clashes between angels and demons, as overt as I can be without, you know, within the bounds that we've been given. And then there's also, I don't know if are you familiar with Charles Williams, Taliesin Through Logris?
I've heard of it. I've never read any Charles Williams. He's honestly kind of intimidated me just because of the allegations that he was like kind of an occultist.
Yeah. Well, he was in the occult. That's true.
I mean, I'll probably read him at some point, I think, because Tim Powers is very much influenced by him.
He pretty decisively left the occult, so...
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's like with Arthur Machen's the same, you know? I mean, he never got really as far into it, but he definitely left, you know, and became more of a devout Christian, so, yeah.
Yeah, well, he wrote this Arthurian cycle, or started it, he never finished it, but in it, he's got this character... who's kind of the clash goes three ways, where you've got Arthur and the Emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor, who are, you know, Christendom, and then you have the rise of Islam, which is, it's not all bad. There's a lot of good in it, and some of the greatest heroes come from it. So you've got characters too, which, and that's out of the actual, the old Arthurian legends. You have these Muslim knights who wander through and actually like become parts of the stories and stuff like that. But then Williams creates this third kingdom, that's kind of ruled over by this, I guess it's like a squid creature that rises out of the sea, and it brings like chaos and disaster, and its influence is what destroys Logres, disintegrates Logres, because the Logres sort of like fractures within itself, and then the evil of this black kingdom is able to get in and wreck it. And I like that idea of personifying the evil that the hero is resisting, because it does help you sort of get your head around it. So I'm toying with giving some kind of mythical, because that isn't something interesting about Joan. It's not really clear what the evil is that she's resisting.
Yeah.
Like King Henry, it's not really that bad of a guy.
Right. The English aren't terrible. I mean, they're kind of bad, you know, but.
But we all love Henry V. We're all on Henry's side in Henry V, and then you got a couple decades later, all of a sudden we all hate him. It's just kind of, it's not this like really clear good versus evil in Joan's story. But you know Joan is good.
Right.
And she is resisting something, so that thing must be evil. But I'm not clear on what it is, honestly.
Something going on behind the scenes of history, you know, like some big metaphysical struggle or something. Yeah.
Yeah, there's something that's trying to dismantle God's order, and Joan is the thing standing in its way.
Yeah.
So that's what I really want to get at in this poetic cycle, is what is Joan doing?
Yeah.
Which is so funny that we're all still asking that. Like, if you ask someone on the street, do you know who Joan of Arc is? They will know.
Right.
But I don't think they, I think most people couldn't tell you who she was fighting.
Right.
Which is kind of an incredible testimony to her, because good is rarely that incandescent. It's usually, you understand good in conflict with evil, you know, like you understand like the good guy versus the bad guy. But to have something where it's just that, like, only the good has shown out through history is just really rare. I don't know. I just really love her. So I'm not exactly sure what this cycle is going to be about, but it's going
to
be fun.
It's going to be fun. I like that. Yeah, it sounds great. I know you have a cold, so I'll let you go. So we actually got over a bunch of illnesses too. So we all had like a stomach flu a couple weeks ago. And the thing that happened to me, so... I think I'm lactose intolerant now. The doctor thinks so. Yeah. And so I got a stomach flu, and then I got better, and then I was like bloated, like just for no reason, it seemed. And so I go into the doctor, and then they're like, "Oh, well, let's have a CT scan." So I just got that. Still don't have the results, but the blood work came back fine. And he's like, "Yeah, it's probably dietary." And I'm like, "Oh, okay." So I think I'm lactose intolerant, which is a thing that happens apparently after you get the stomach flu. You just become permanently lactose intolerant. So that's fun.
Delightful.
Yeah, really great. It's just nice.
Aging. It's a lovely thing.
I know. The Minnesotan can't eat dairy, you know, without help anyway.
This isn't going to go well for you.
Right. Yeah. Anyway, so...
thanks for having me. This was really fun.
This was fun. And I do want to pick your brain at some point about what you think of Tim Powers.
Oh, yeah, we definitely should.
Yeah, because I thought about just having a Tim Powers podcast, but I don't think I'd get the interest.
maybe you could get Tim Powers to come on.
I did. I had him on. I'll have him on again at some point, too. Yeah.
No, I didn't even know that. I haven't been following it closely enough then. I've only, at True Confession, I've only listened to like a half dozen of your podcasts.
That's okay.
But that's actually pretty good because I don't listen to podcasts at all. So that's...
Well, thank you.
Special. Yeah.
I'm special. I like to hear that I'm special. Well, I know. So, okay, one more question and I'll let you go. It's kind of a bit of a tangent, but we're back on track. So this podcast is called I Might Believe in Fairies. And as we've discussed, I don't know if they exist or not, but I want to know if you, Jane Charles, believe in fairies.
Oh, certainly.
All right. Mm-hmm. What do you think they are?
I don't know.
You think they're like the lost children of Eve or like dead kings of old or pagan gods or?
Well, I tend to think they're something that doesn't have to do with us.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'd probably take, and if there's a priest listening, please correct me if this is a heresy. I'm not going to like willing to release this belief. It makes sense to me. Sort of an Aristotelian view of it, that there could be, you know, because Aristotle said that everything had a spirit. Mm-hmm. It just that the spirits behave differently. So like a tree has a spirit and a rock has a spirit. It's just they just behave differently. So it makes sense to me that at certain periods of time, those spirits could be more or less evident. So I tend to think of fairies as things that are so connected to this created order that they won't persist in eternity, but that they are serving God in the way that animals do and trees, that they're serving God in their own way or not serving God.
Sure.
There could be, you know, perverted ones as well. That's kind of my sense. And I do tend to think that they are passing, that as, cause I think, I mean, the whole created order is passing, so it would make sense that they would be going away. That's what I think.
Awesome. Yeah, I heard a theory once that it was very interesting. The reason we don't see them as much is because we're not rooted to a particular place as we used to be anymore. So you have like people who live, you know, on this plot of land for like five generations will start to see weird things, you know, because their bodies and their being is like connected to the land in a way that like mine is not, right? Like I live in West St. Paul. I grew up, you know, in like Cottage Grove, Minnesota. You know, I'm not like on the same piece of land that my ancestors have been on for generations. So like, you know, you eat the food that the land provides and you like get more attuned to the land, then you can start to see like the spirit. Maybe that's the spirits of these trees. You can actually start to see the like actual spirit or something like that. I was like, wow, that's really interesting. I have no idea if that's true, but I guess I don't have a way to test it. So
Just tell your children live here for the next five generations. Yeah. And report back.
Right, and then report back to me. Right, like we'll meet up in heaven, and you can tell me all about it. So yeah, well
that's what I think.
Yeah, thank you for coming on my show. This has been really fun.
I did want to say, if any of your listeners are in New York City.
Oh, yes, please.
Opening, it's on February 21st. You can go to Eventbrite and just type in Sonny Le Matina, which is SonnyLesMatines, and get tickets and come.
Awesome. Yes, thank you. I was going to promote that. And your book, your play is published by Wise Blood Books.
Yes.
And I'll put a link in the show notes to all that stuff. I'll find the Eventbrite thing too and try to put that in there. So yes. Great. And it's February 21st, right?
February 21st. Okay. And then we have a second showing on March 1st. I won't be there on March 1st because I don't live in New York, but I'll be there on February 21st.
Awesome. Yeah. I wanted this to come out.
Which is Mardi Gras, by the way.
Oh, wow. I wanted this to come out before that. So this will come out on the 30th. So you're hearing this now, but it'll come out on the 30th. There'll be plenty of time if you're in the New York area to buy tickets. So yeah, thank you. I thank you for reminding me about that.
Oh yeah. No, I just want to make sure everybody knew. So, thank you so much, Aaron. I appreciate it a lot.
Thank you for listening to this episode of I Might Believe in Fairies. Please leave a rating and review wherever you listen to podcasts. Please follow me on Twitter at Aaron Erber and like me on Facebook. If you're excited to see where the podcast is going and want to offer some support for the project, you can find me on Patreon. Music is by Alexander Nakarada, and podcast art was designed by my wonderful sister-in-law, Linnea Kisby. Until next time, talk to you soon.